Blog Talk Radio. God bless you. We're coming on this Divine Healing Night, which is Saturday night. I know everybody went and got their Powerball ticket. And people called me and said, Bishop, should I give it? I said, hey, go for it. I want to say to you tonight, I'm praying for you, you, and you. I want to thank Sister Pearl for her testimony last night. I want to thank Mary Hawkins that read that scripture last night. And we're talking about tonight, we're going to deal with something very serious. The race moved in 19, what happened in 19, the 19th century, how Americans got rich off of black folks. Let me say that again. Somebody said, Bishop, I can't hear what you're saying. I'm going to say it again. Maybe you might understand what I'm saying. I won't get no feedback. I want to get it directly from the horse's mouth, okay? Now, those that are listening tonight, to somebody else. Now, one of the things I'm saying, what happened in the 20th century, what made America rich was the black man with the work, the labor work that went on. You know, now, Mr. Bishop, what I'm saying? I'm saying black folks worked for nothing. We made cotton king, and we made tobacco king right there in Virginia. And we made sugar cane king right there in Louisiana. So we know that we work. We know our ancestors didn't get paid, so I don't need to argue about that. Where we go from here, what we do from here. Thing is, you get ready for action from Michael, Raphael, Hamiel, and all the archangels. You get ready to do something special for you. Now, I don't do no feedback, but I want you to know God is able to live here. I'm praying for those that lost loved ones. There's no sorrow on earth that heaven cannot heal. Let me say that again. Somebody not heard me. Somebody said, God's going to do it in a hurry. And I want you to get ready. And for God to bless you and call me. Let me give you my number where you can call. I want somebody to call me tonight. Pearl, give me a call. That's 708-582-0372. That's area code 312-582-0323. Them that call me on this number, 312-582-0372. I got a special word for you. Them that call me 708-582-0372, I got a message directly from God. God told me if three people call, tell them. If 100 people call, give them the word of God. Maybe you don't want to hear from God. But if you call me at 708-582-0372 and you need to plant a seed for your need, whatever need you got, you begin to plant the seed and watch God take over. This is Dr. Henry Clark talking about Africans, how they migrated to America.
All African people, Caribbean African, African-American, African, the Africans in the Pacific. One of the reasons why I have not been here because I have been doing a lot of work on spirituality in the last year or so, more than in recent years. And more than in recent years, I've come to believe that our assault on our enemies is going to have to be cultural, spiritual, and physical. It's going to be, have to be physical too, but it's going to have to be cultural and spiritual. And when we speak of spiritual, I'm speaking of the kind of spirituality we had before Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I am not talking about when we had no religion, because we have always had religion. I'm talking about that period of spirituality before someone broke it down into denominations and began to start dissension between people based on who belonged to which one. Now, my subject for tonight, and this is the ninth in a 10-lecture series, one more lecture to go in this 10-part series, then I will take some time off to systematically plan the African-American series of lectures. And it deals with African resistance movement, and my focal point is the 19th century. My focal point is the 19th century because we have to look at the 19th century again, not just in Africa. We have to look at the 19th century again all over the world, because the 19th century was the greatest century that we have lived outside of Africa. This was the foundation century. It was the century of the building of the black church. It was the century of the agitation for independence, for agitation against slavery. The first half was the century of agitation against slavery. The first half was also the century when hatred, agitation, met Napoleon and drained the French treasury to a point where he had to sell the Louisiana Territory. When three black men, Toussaint Louverture, Jesse Lely, Christophe, stood up against this fascist Frenchman and did not yield and drained the French treasury to the point he had to sell Louisiana and that territory in order to recoup his money to continue his stupid wars in Europe. Now, Napoleon might be a hero to you. He's an idiot to me. But now, and yet, this country would not be the same except for these three black men who dared to stand up to him and wouldn't let him take Haiti, wouldn't let him re-enslave Haiti. That's the first half of the 19th century. Also, the first half of the 19th century in the United States, that was the century of Frederick Douglass. That was the century of the building of the black church, the rise of the AME church. Central Fabric and Richard Allen, the century of the Freedom Journal, the first black newspaper. Frederick Douglass is the North Star, Douglass is monthly, the first half of the 19th century in this country. The century of the dynamic black preacher in this country. The century of a great preacher like Henry Highland Garnett, whose motto, he said, is resistance, resistance, resistance. I'm saying that all of that focal point this evening is on Africa. Any place in the world where there were African people can show you that we want this and that for this revolutionary doing that sentence. And this is our only sentence. I'm saying that all the movements today are weaker. Because we don't see the world out. We are still successful in that 19th century all over the world. To afraid that the Haitians were too stubborn and just kept on fighting and fighting with the land and fighting with the hills and the valleys and malaria too, a general that helped them a great deal in the African drum, driving these French dark, raving mad, that helped a lot. All right, now, if you look at, see now, because the British have emancipated, or said something about emancipation, before the period, as early as the 1830s, but when it came to the 1850s, the Caribbean people understood the fakery of that emancipation and started their revolt again. In Jamaica, this led to the confrontation at Morette Bay. But Barbados, a model colony, then and now, still a colony, in mentality. Because they wanted to make it a model colony, they gave it a certain kind of treatment. I remember a few months ago stating that Jamaica was physically bastardized, Barbados was mentally bastardized. One they dealt with the mind, the other one they dealt with the body. And they split them in the division. All right, now, that's the first half of the 19th century. But the second half of the 19th century in this country, the second half of the 19th century was the century after emancipation, when the abolitionists, all the white liberals we thought were our friends, began to pull away from us, permitted the South to come back to power, and subsequently started the Ku Klux Klan and other organizations, and we were back in the same trouble again. Now, while you had a basis of constitutional law in the Caribbean, you had some stuff here, but you had something in the Caribbean we didn't have. You had a majority population. And while you have a majority, though you are under colonial rule, you have a different psychosis. You have a different mentality. And this different mentality, brought on by butchering, that they could maintain some African culture continuity. And many times, they were away from the oppressor and could develop certain basic cultural traits based on their togetherness. Near the end of the 19th century, it was practically all gone by virtue of one form of oppression, one form of cohesion than the other. And what the British did not win with weaponry, they began to win with a form of brainwashing that's still prevalent. To the point, this year, the 100th anniversary of the birth of Marcus Garvey, and we need to reconsider Marcus Garvey. In spite of the fact that his 100th year anniversary of his birth, there's not a single island in the Caribbean where he could function, in peace right now. If he was in Jamaica right now, he couldn't get elected to public office. If he was in Grenada, they could have. If he's to lie about a dead man, you ain't got to deal with it. If he's here to bend the sides, he's going to do anything. They're congressmen out of it. But in Kingston, it's over there. Right now. You have no problem with the title. Get elected, they want to get elected over here. You might make him a tenant down. With or without a law degree. he'd be all right over here. He wouldn't be all right in Jason. So the atmosphere that would sustain a monster God does not exist in Jamaica of today. Does not exist on a single Caribbean island right now. In most parts of the United States, it does not exist. It does not exist in Washington, D.C. That color conscious class, conscious bunch of blacks in Washington, D.C., they chase them out of town. Better not go to Atlanta University, go to Atlanta either. There's a crowd there. So let's be frank about where Marcus Garvey could exist in America right now. Where he could exist in Caribbean. I don't know a single island where he could exist in Caribbean. He couldn't exist in Caribbean at all. You go down to Caribbean, people boasting about participating in the invasion of Grenada and rationalizing on the murder of Louis Bishop. Yeah. Now, what would they do to Marcus Garvey? All right, now let's get to work. We got a little job here on African resistance movement focused on the 19th century. But my main point to let you know, while I'm talking about 19th century Africa, our resistance movement was international. All of us in the 19th century were very conscious of the fact that we had a world struggle, and we engaged in that world struggle. And we were more together then than we are now. We were less divided into little silly pockets based on islands, based on countries, based on sororities and fraternities, and a whole lot of other nonsense. We didn't have all that. We weren't that worried about that then as we are now. See, we did not know then, as I tell some of my students, that, all right, you're talking about where you're from, who you are, when you pass the taxi cab test. Will cab downtown pick you up? They don't care whether you're from Africa, whether you're from the Caribbean Islands, or whether you're from Georgia. Your face is black, and if it's kind of late at night, you ain't going to get no cab. You're all the same. You fail the taxi cab test. All one people. So in a negative way, this digging a cab driver is a better pan-Africanist than you are. In a negative way, of course. All right, now, let's start with Africa in the 19th century. Because in the 19th century, slavery had reached a saturation point. Saturation point means everybody who wanted one had one. And they could breed one if they needed one. Therefore, more slaves for the market wasn't really much of a problem. They had shifted so many slaves out of Africa. They had depopulated large areas of Africa. Now, the United States had produced a fast ship that could outrun the British ship at speed. Therefore, the United States that once brought most of its slaves from the British and the Portuguese market was now going directly to Africa and getting its own slaves, still using more and more slaves because the invention of the cotton gin and the rise in the price of cotton being king economically, America had more demand for slaves than the other. So with the Yankee Clipper type of ship, mostly out of New England, America was going bypassing the British market bypassing the British blockade and picking up our slaves directly from Africa. This is why the British began to get a fake reputation for benevolence by starting the British abolitionist movement with a faker called Wilberforce and Gordon Jeffs. Most of the British abolitionists were fakers. Most of them did not support any decent legislation in England improving the lot of the British people, especially legislation against child labor and the abuse and the use of women. So therefore, when they were crying crocodile tears over the slaves, they had no tears and no sympathy for the common people in England. And Wilberforce, so-called Christian, when he met Ikuero, the African, the most brilliant of the African slave narrators and writers who had traveled a great deal, he was an educated man, educated more than some of the whites he met. Wilberforce could not shake his hand and said, so I could not bring myself to put my hand in his hand and call him a brother, though he was a Christian, the same as I am. So Wilberforce's religion did not prepare him to accept another African as a Christian. All right, now, the African slaves in England itself had been emancipated slowly, not out of benevolence, but because the British working class, with its large unemployment problem, seeing these Africans with these nice jobs, nice, they interpreted nice, footmen, coachmen, said that they wanted those jobs, and that agitation eventually led to emancipation of the African slaves, and the British began to dump them at Sierra Leone. Now, the British, with that customary sense of humor, once they dumped the African slaves at Sierra Leone, they found two shiploads of British women, ladies of the evening and ladies of the night and ladies of whatever, ladies with no visible means of support except the use of their charm. We call it charm, for one of the better names. They dumped those people, those ladies, and the Sierra Leone. England was very good at getting rid of its scum. Europe dumped its human garbage can into the New World. The worst of the lot came to the United States. One thing the Caribbean people and the African people never appreciated is that the Black American had to deal with absolutely the worst white people ever. They had to deal with the worst that Europe put off with, the leftovers, the discards of Europe, and we're still dealing with the discards. These people just don't think. They don't make no kind of sense. What they're doing, they don't make no kind of legal. You can't figure them out no kind of way. They even against each other. As we face, as Africa faced the beginning of this century, let's take it from the top. Let's look at North Africa. In North Africa, what do you have? You have Egypt under the control of foreigners, Maluk, Armenians, Turks. While the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, have retreated, they've left behind administrators and people holding on to power. They even have a combination Armenian and Turkish royal family on the throne of Egypt. King Farouk, that little fat degenerate, was an Armenian in combination Armenian and Turk. And he had all kinds of women and men that he performed all kind of relations with. But the Arabs, who were Puritans, pretend to be Puritans in sexual matters, came to him and said that you can treat these foreign women any way you want, but we have no control of that. But if ever you misbehave this way with a gentleman, Arab woman, we're going to kill you no matter how much it takes. And ultimately, they did drive him off the throne. The people, let's deal with his descendants first. Because Muhammad Ali is one of his descendants. Now, Muhammad Ali is a prize fighter who really is not brilliant. I met him changing planes in Miami, and I said, so if you wanted an African name, why do you consult somebody who could give you a genuine African name? This is the name of an Arab slave trader. That's, the name that was approved for him. He submitted the name to Elijah Muhammad, and that's the name they approved. They didn't know much about it anyway. But anybody could have told him that Muhammad Ali really was not a favorite man. He tried to turn Egypt toward the West, and fighting up Egypt. But the main thing I'm trying to get at is that foreign control of Egypt and North Africa was intact at the beginning of the century. The English wanted a peace, so she had to try to drive out the Turks. And the French wanted the peace and had to drive out part of the Turks. So the French got Morocco. The English took part control over Egypt. Then when the Egyptians got in trouble trying to take over the Sudan, the British rescued them. Then the British took over the Sudan, ostensibly in partnership with the Egyptians, but they were never in partnership. The British were controlling it all along. But all over Africa, there were revolts. There were revolts against colonial rule because colonialism was now gradually, slavery was now gradually turning to a more sophisticated form of slavery called colonialism. And the Africans, who thought he was getting rid of one form of slavery, was only inheriting another form of slavery, and he was beginning to catch on to this form of slavery. In North Africa, again, the French began to use the foreign legion, tried to hold on to its holding. Now, the foreign legion and all the romance about it were nothing but a bunch of thugs recruited from all the waste matter of Europe, royal corrupts and social misfits and a whole lot of people who escaped, and some of them escaped criminals, wanted to hide their identity. But there was a whole lot of Hollywood romance and B-movies about them, but really, they were nothing but well-dressed gangsters, sometimes on a horse. Now, the French, with the Foreign Legion, held their part. The British, who recruited African troops to hold that part, but the Egyptians tried to control the Sudan. And when the Egyptians tried to control the Arabs of Egypt, that's probably the best way to put it, because the Arab is not an Egyptian. when the Arabs of Egypt tried to control the Sudan and got hell beat out of them, they had to call for the British to rescue them, and in rescuing them, the British gained control both of Egypt and the Sudan. Now, this would provoke wars later on. Now you see the foundation of what is going to ultimately be wars led by the Mahdi, the holy man who would free the Sudan from British rule, but later on, but not now. All right, now. Now you see the war is spreading down the coast of East Africa. And the Arabs had moved down the coast of East Africa. It moved down the coast of East Africa surreptitiously, doing favors for certain families, marrying into the families, and playing the same kind of game he had played almost 1,000 years along that coast, marrying into African families and subsequently using this family, using in the slave trade and in his commodity trade along the coast. He is a unique oppressor inasmuch as he recruits people in a physical way to perform a sexual conquest, because the Arab is a big womanizer and a big conflator of the woman and her family as servants in his trade, be it ever so licit. This is the way he gained control of the East African slave trade and maintained this trade until the fakery of the British would bring him kind of thoroughly to bear with the fact that the African Muslim was really an oppressor. Not that the British was any different, just that the British had the kind of weaponry that could dislodge the Arabs from the East African slave trade. Now, the resistance in East Africa continued. And the resistance continued until East Africa and the Sudan. A young man whose people were very religious called Fakers, F-A-K-K-E-R-S. These were religious Muslims, high religious Muslims, named Muhammad Ahmed. Now, this young man had rose to some prominence as a student because his family was puritanical Muslim, and he took on his teacher for permitting the students to frolic and laugh during one of the holy days. And they thought that because he did this, he must be some kind of future prophet. This is the character you saw in the picture cartoon, so poorly portrayed and so inaccurately portrayed in the picture cartoon. Well, what did happen is that he went into a period of training in the Upper Nile. And when he was about 19, he asked that a wife be chosen for him. And this wife, if they left out of the movie, he asked that she be the prettiest and the blackest woman in all the Sudan. And so they found a person who had had 1 year of college training and a tremendously beautiful woman. And she was the number one wife and remained so until a few years later he began to take on additional wives. And she had to approve of all the additional ones. And she converted all of this into a spy system that used against the British. All right. Now, this one individual planning his wars against the British literally drove the British out of the Sudan and started a movement using Islam as a rallying cry. What you have to understand now is there are two Islams in Africa. This is what Alan Mazaroy did not tell you in the series on the Africa. There are two Islams in Africa. One Africa, one Arab. The African side of Islam has used Islam as a rallying cry for reform. And so the Mahdi, that means after he became the Holy Man, that's what he's called, he began to use Islam as a rallying cry. But he united all of the Sudan, Muslim and non-Muslim. And some of his most effective fighters for those people, non-Muslim, called Fuzzy Wuzzy. They decided that they wasn't going to get a haircut or a shave until the British were driven out. They were magnificent warriors and great camouflage artists. They must be some of the finest physically trained people ever, because they could sit, stand, or fall right in front of a horse. Their knowledge of the movement of the horse was so good, they knew that at all times, two of those feet are off the ground. And they would leave their body in such a way that the horse could pass right over them without hurting them. And then they would leap with that knife, they would leap and cut the throat on the rider behind. And before he fall, his knife is in the throat of another rider. This is what Rudyard Kipling said in his "Hey, ye fuzzy wuzzy, ye break the British square." That's what he was talking about. That British square attack, they would come in squares around and come on the, you know, come from all sides. That's all the fuzzy wuzzy wanted. All he wanted. You come up on him that way, you never dream again. Some of the finest hand fighters. That's not his really name now. But the Mahdi got the upper hand in the Sudan. Then they sent in a colonial fighter who had distinguished himself in the Boxer War in China. Chinese Gordon. One of those one-dimensional British military men who are, well, we can't get into military men with gender problems, but he was one. So he had no concentration. When you rule women out of your life and rule all other things out of your life and just concentrate on the military, you know, you can concentrate real well over. That's a whole lot of time you freed up with. Whole lot of energy, too. But he was one of those that kicked in. So Gordon, a Christian, had been there before, and he had some converts. But Gordon couldn't free the Sudan from the Mahdi. Yeah. And eventually was killed by one of the Mahdi people, the Dongolas. Now the Sudan became free of British rule. And after the death of the Mahdi, the Sudan came under the control of a man of the Mahdi's children, Khalifa Abdul Hayya. Khalifa Abdul-Hayya was an illiterate, stone illiterate, but a master on a horse with a weapon in his hand, he mastered the Sudan. He was so unlearned about people, he saw a Frenchman, he said, what tribe, why are these white tribes belong to? And no question of who he is. I got enough pictures of him. Back to my ID from the Dongola group, and Dongola was the blackest people in Sudan. Now, the British sent in another one-dimensional general, Hitchin. And he took the British, he took the Sudan. This war is reported by a young British reporter, Winston Churchill. And one of the great classics of war reporting called the River War. I'm not saying it's for you now. Mr. Churchill was a racist. He was unashamed of it. Churchill boasted of the fact that they killed 50,000 Africans in one evening. But it was great graphic reporting. I said it's one of the finest jobs of war reporting since Caesar came home from the war with the Gauls. But don't look for it being for you. It wasn't for you at all. It's for them. So sometimes, if you're going to deal with them, you got to understand how they report on each other. Now, the next war in East Africa is by a man named Mohammed bin Abdullah Hassan. The British called him the Mad Mullah of Somaliland. He was a great poet, a devout Muslim, and he had fought the British near the end of the century, and he had gone to Mecca and Medina. He had gone to preach in a city called Babra, still in existence. And 7 years after he had failed at Babra, he came to the edge of the city and said that Allah had told him to push the sea, push the city into the sea with his feet. And he had come to do just that. But then he said that he do not want to harm innocent people. And if the British would turn over so much ammunition to him, so much this and so many harms to him, he might consent to spare the city. The British gave him enough ammunition to fight them 3 more years. They never laid eyes on him. He fought until the 20s. So after the First World War, Winston Churchill suggested that he put some Alpines on some ships and bomb his inland fortress. And they bombed his inland fortresses. He retreated into Ethiopia, and he tried to proposition Haile Selassie's alleged father, Ras Magona. And I won't get into the lineage of Haile Selassie. He was just as true as many other people sit on the throne, although there's some question about his parentage. He wasn't Magona. Because, well, I've seen Haile Selassie close up 3 times. And I've seen the Magona close up more than 3 times. There was no Makona eyes, there was not a Makona nose, there was not a Makona lip. I'm especially considering facial features and family lineages as reflected in the physical makeup